Hello everyone, Joshua Gilliland here, one of the founding attorneys of the Legal Geeks. With me is Nari Ely, and we will discuss Gamera 2, Attack of Legion, or Advent of Legion, depending on what translation you watch. How you doing today, Nari?
Doing pretty good. We're in, week whatever of quarantine with who knows how many weeks to go, but doing just fine. I think just 2 weeks ago or so started a new job for me at the federal courts, which has been very exciting. Did receive permission to continue with the podcasting. So I'm happy to be here.
That is awesome. And we'll just leave it at that for what you're doing with the federal courts. And just as I've joined a law firm, and we'll leave that vague as well. So yes, all good things are out there. And yeah, as we gather on this Blur's Day to discuss Gamera.
I have not heard that before, Blur's Day. Oh, that's so perfect.
Yeah, because again, when are we? I don't know, when are we?
I know.
It's like when you're a kid and it's summertime, everything's just one big blur. And it's sunny, and we're going to talk about the giant jet-powered flying turtle known as Gamera and the sequel to Guardian of the Universe, which is, I think, it's my favorite kaiju film. I heard one podcast where the host said, depending on their mood, could determine the answer of which do they like more, Attack of Legion or Revenge of Iris, that it really could depend on their blood sugar. And they're not wrong on which is the best, because both of these movies are exceptional. And we'll talk a lot about the lessons from this film. Opening up with the beginning of this film, we have NASA, and it's, again, Japan's version of how they see NASA, so grain of salt. And there is a near-Earth object that's going to crash into Earth, and it's the asteroid or meteorite that carries Legion. And it is some wonderful sci-fi when we actually get to the science of Legion, of what this creature or creatures are. But it raises this interesting question of, if NASA sees an object coming towards Earth, what do we do about it?
Yeah.
Did we just sit on the information and go like, wow, that's going to leave a really big crater, bummer. Which is kind of what NASA does this time around. Like, they don't warn anyone. And that seems kind of uncool.
Well, so, detecting near-Earth objects is actually a pretty big concern of our government, of a lot of governments around the world, for pretty obvious reasons. Aside from planet-ending asteroids or objects, there are plenty of asteroids out there in the universe that could at least, flatten a large area of the planet, sometimes called city killer asteroids and things like that. So, and it turns out that detection of these things is, it's not something that you can usually, it's very difficult to do by yourself. You need to have lots of assets looking at the sky all the time, basically, in order to detect some of these things. Because it turns out that a lot of asteroids are made of materials that are not very shiny, so it's very difficult to detect them in the blackness of space, even when they get relatively close to Earth. So I think, Josh, you pulled up for us some U.S. law governing this kind of stuff. Would you like to tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, and so some of this dates back to the Bush 43 administration on, apparently people were watching sci-fi movies. And, Bush 43 did things like read a book about the 1918 pandemic and said, like, whoa, we better do something in case this comes back. And kind of proven him right. And Obama built on it. And similar things happened with, what do we do if there's a giant asteroid? So 51 USC section 71103, pardon me, allergies, which states, within 2 years after October 15th, 2008, the director of the Office of Science and Technology Policy shall develop a policy for notifying federal agencies and relevant emergency response institutions of an impending near-Earth object threat, if near-term public safety is at risk, and to recommend a federal agency or agencies to be responsible for A, protecting the United States from a near-Earth object that is expected to collide with Earth, and B, implementing a deflection campaign in consultation with international bodies should one be necessary. This is then updated. So we're now into the Obama years, and this is the update is the director of the OSTP, that's the Office of Science, Technology, and Policy, shall implement before September 30th, 2012, a policy for notifying federal agencies and relevant emergency response institutions of an impending near-Earth object threat if near-term public safety is at risk, and assign a federal agency or agencies to be responsible for protecting the United States and working with the international community on such threats. Because we're not just going to sit around and take and go like, ooh, this could be a bummer. And continuing on, the administration may carry out a program to competitively award cash prizes to stimulate innovation in basic and applied research, technology development, and prototype demonstration that have the potential for application to the performance of the space and aeronautic activities of the administration. The administration may carry out a program to award prizes only in conformity with this section, topics for prize competitions, the administrator shall consult widely both within and outside the federal government and may in panel advisory committees. The administrator shall be given consideration for such prize goals, such as the demonstration of the ability to provide energy to the lunar surface from space-based solar power systems, demonstration of innovation near Earth object survey and deflection strategies, and innovation approaches to improving the safety and efficiency of aviation systems. So the goal is deflect. It's not blow up said asteroid, it's deflect it because—
Yes, although as it turns out, those goals are often related.
Yeah.
what I mean is that it is actually a strategy and I don't want to take complete credit for this. I actually learned this by watching other podcasts. But it is actually one of the strategies that we have for dealing with a potential planet-killing asteroid is to actually launch a nuclear weapon at it, not with the goal of blowing it up. Because if it's a large enough piece of solid rock or probably metal, you're unlikely to vaporize it. And even if you do break it up into pieces, you've just created a bunch of city-killing asteroids that are now going to come hurtling at Earth. Instead, the goal is typically just to, for the nuclear device to basically impact with enough force and energy so as to change the trajectory of the asteroid. So that's a thing. That's actually, so I believe, oh, what was the Bruce Willis movie about this?
Armageddon. So there was
that one
as opposed to Deep Impact, which highlights the need for security at movie studios before making a movie.
But the point is that those things are like slightly less ridiculous than you might think, slightly less science fiction and a little more science than you might think at first blush. But the other side that is at least, you know, especially relevant to our perspective as lawyers is that there is both a need for international cooperation on this, and there has been some put into effect in international law. So as I was saying just a little bit ago, it is very difficult to detect these asteroids. Even when you do find one, you need to be able to determine its trajectory. So typically what that means is you need to take a lot of observations of the position of the asteroid relatively quickly to figure out it's where it's headed. And in order to do that, you usually need to be using the night side of the Earth constantly. and in fact, the asteroid might be such that if you are one particular country, you might not get a chance to look at it while it's nighttime for you, just because of the where the asteroid is positioned relative to the sun. So international observation using all different points on the planet turns out to be actually quite important. In about, I believe it was like 2012 or 2013 or so, the UN actually created an organization called the International Asteroid Warning Network, and the United States has been a signatory and a member of this since 2015, April of 2015. And it's exactly what I was just talking about. It's supposed to be an international clearinghouse for detections of near-Earth objects and for tracking of them. So in order to promote the kind of international cooperation you need to successfully track these things, as well as, it hasn't happened yet, of course, thank God, but if there were a planet-killing asteroid headed towards Earth, undoubtedly it would be beneficial if there were international cooperation on the deflection effort. I do note, Japan is not currently a member of the International Asteroid Warning Network, so maybe this is why nobody picked up the phone to give them a call.
Hey, does anyone know anybody in Japan? They're going to want to know about this. Larry? Could you? Yeah, it's that's rough.
In reality, of course, Japan is one of our oldest or one of our strongest and relatively old allies. It is very unlikely that nobody would have alerted anyone in Japan that they had detected a near-Earth object on a collision course for Earth, especially because you just don't know where it's going to hit. It's very difficult to predict with precision where something is going to hit.
The president would call the prime minister. Like, that's just the way it would go down of like, hey, wake up. You guys are going to get really busy super fast. Mm-hmm. And yeah, but it's a big sky to watch. So
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, my not terribly expert understanding of this, though, is that there is a lot of international cooperation in this field, even before the official implementation of the International Asteroid Warning Network. It would be, yeah, extremely unlikely that the United States would not be on the phone with, you know, all of its allies, not to mention, you know, anyone who wants to know about the near-Earth object.
Yeah, good neighbor policy. Like, we would tell Canada if something was headed their way. Like, we would not sit back and get out the popcorn. Like, we would take action because it's
and wait to steal their maple syrup. Yes, we would not be doing that.
It's going to impact us literally as well. So whether it's a micro nuclear winter or something radically unpleasant, we're going to want to know what's happening.
Definitely.
So we see the police officer from the first movie who's now a security guard because dealing with Gauss really disturbed his sense of zen. He clearly has...
He wasn't cut out for it, is what he said.
So he's security guard for Kieran Beer. And naturally, the Legion goes there. And he's the first human to encounter one of these creatures.
Of course, ironically, Legion did not go there to partake of the delicious Kirin beer, which, by the way, I am drinking a Japanese beer. Unfortunately, I couldn't get Kirin, but it is Sapporo. But somehow Legion decides not to partake of the delicious beer, but instead eats the bottles, right? Leaving the beer behind. Of course, not in usable form anymore, very sadly.
No, and it's hysterical. Both you and the lead female character had the exact same reaction of like,
yes!
The beer. And that was adorable. I got to say, like, wow.
You exactly the same reaction. Yes.
That was awesome. So the more you know, there would be complex insurance claims to fill out for Kieran because all of the bottles were absorbed because it's silicon-based life and that's what Legion eats, they're consuming. So they wasted the beer, but they ate the bottles and loss of that product. So there would definitely mm-hmm. be an insurance claim for what had happened. Now we do see a subway train that is like right out of a horror movie. This does have some elements of, say, like Aliens, but different. And so they encounter...
I just want to know, it was a very different... this was the first moment that I realized that this movie was not Gamera Garden of the Universe. Gamera Garden of the Universe, I believe all of the scariest stuff, all of the people who, you know, were eaten by Gauss and stuff like that happened off screen. So this was a dramatic difference. Good, but definitely different.
Yeah, this one's hardcore because you realize, oh, this could be life ending if this continues. Yes. With the subway scene, we see the cars rolling and the engineer sees something's wrong with the track. So he comes to a stop and sees that the tracks have been ripped apart by Legion, but he doesn't know that yet.
So yeah, of course he doesn't know. He just sees damaged track and rubble.
No, he doesn't get out of the train, so he doesn't make that rookie mistake. But he does walk out a window, and it, you know, again, you think like, have you not seen horror movies?
Oh yeah. So I was definitely shouting at the camera here, and I watched this with Josh for the benefit of our viewers. I'll mention that. So he got to hear me being the person in the movie theater saying, "What are you doing? Hit the reverse. What are you doing?" But yes, at this point, you'd think that there would be some protocol for getting out of the way of danger if it appears that there's a dangerous situation. But go ahead.
Yeah, so it raises interesting common carrier questions. And yes. Nari, could you go over just some of the basic elements of what is a common carrier and what could have happened based upon the situation?
Right. So just as a little bit of an explainer, so common carriers, which are, you know, roughly defined as anyone who transports passengers for hire. So the subway in this case, pretty clearly a common carrier, are held to a higher standard, a higher legal standard than most other people and most other people operating vehicles. Typically, vehicle operators are held to a simple negligence standard. Typically, just people are held to a negligence standard. And we could, Josh and I could do a whole podcast just explaining what is meant by a duty of reasonable care, because this is a whole topic. You take a whole course on it in your first year of law school. It's a long, lengthy topic. All of the states have slightly different takes on it. But basically, to summarize it as simply as possible, you and I, Josh and I, and you listening, owe a duty of care to others, in most circumstances, to exercise the same level of care that a, quote, reasonable person, end quote, would do under the circumstances. Common carriers, on the other hand, have to exercise greater than reasonable care. I actually wasn't able to find this code specifically for DC, and my guess is just because DC covers so little geographic area, this isn't a huge field of concern, but common carriers in California must use the, quote, utmost care and diligence for their safe care, for passenger safe carriage, and must provide everything necessary for that purpose, and must exercise to that end a reasonable degree of skill. That's California Civil Code section 2100, if anyone's curious to look it up. Which, correct me if I'm wrong, Josh, but that sounds a lot higher than your typical negligence standard.
That's because it is a lot higher than your typical negligence standard. If you're running a ferry boat or a train or a taxi, you're responsible for the care of somebody else. So you're not supposed to, like, watch me pop a wheelie. Like, you don't do that.
Well, like it's also, I think, the thing that it implies is not just to not be negligent, right? Because that would just be the reasonable standard of care, but it's the ordinary standard of care. But it's also, I think, like, words that have been used in California cases discussing this standard include things like vigilance and foresight that one can reasonably have and things like that, right? And so ordinarily in negligence law, you can make excuses about, well, we didn't foresee this, or we didn't expect this. And those are usually, good excuses that will help perhaps absolve you of liability, or at least reduce it. If you're being held instead to the common carrier standard, you're instead required to go above and beyond. You're supposed to be extra, you're supposed to be vigilant for possible things that could harm your passengers or derail your trains or things like that.
Yeah. Now, to be fair to the conductor, we've dealt with Gauss in this world. So he's underground. So the idea of like a giant flying reptile that can pick up train cars and eat people, that's probably not on his mind since he's below the surface. Now,
however, it is a world in which they know that kaiju exist.
Yes, because there's the giant flying turtle and the the giant birds that eat people. So like that's what they have to deal with. So they do have some knowledge of kaiju, but there haven't been any subterranean attacks. So right. that's like in his defense. But as soon as you see ripped up train tracks, a light should go off of this is the world with giant flying birds that eat people. We're not at the top of the food chain. I'm stopping this train and then backing the hell up. We're getting out now. Calling headquarters. Don't mess around. Let's go. And he doesn't do that. He does stop so they don't get into an accident. And communications do get garbled, but I don't know if he actually tried contacting anyone. I don't remember if he actually used the radio to try to...
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't think that he did. I think this was the highly suspenseful scene in which he was just trying to figure out what was going on his own.
And things but don't... Even,
yeah, go ahead.
They don't go well.
No. They do not end well for our intrepid conductor, very sadly.
No, if this was Thomas the Train, Ringo would be dead. So yeah, it was wrong. And it is like creepy scary because you hear the Legion outside and like below the train car, and they do the Jaws trick of like you don't get to see the creatures. You get to see like blood splatter up against the wall, glasses go flying off, and you know that people are dying horrifically with these creatures ripping through them, and they do rip through them. But again, it raises interesting common carrier issues of he did stop, so like on that level, duty met, but he should have backed. I think backing up would have been fine. It's not like the track was derailed behind them. It's just back it on up.
I'm sure that there are, you know, protocols and guidelines in terms of, you know, there are possibly trains trying to come down the track somewhere behind them. But I think, again, this would partly turn on this. This is a world in which we know there are kaiju. So in our world, I think this train conductor probably exercised the standard of care applicable to common carriers, that high level. It is an open question, and it would be put to a jury, and it would be a very contentious trial about whether in a world with kaiju, the common carrier, and not just the conductor himself, but the common carrier itself, meaning, you know, did they give him the right level of training? Did they implement the correct protocols? And in a world with kaiju attacks, it is possible and, you know, very plausible that the vigilance that is required, the requirement to do all human care and foresight, was not met by failing to include something in for conductors as just a default protocol when you encounter track that has been destroyed by unknown causes.
And I agree with that. In a world where giant animals can take out an airplane or a ship or a train, pilots, ship captains, ferry boat operators, trolley car, you know, operators, every business would need to have a kaiju evasion plan, just as you have like the earthquake drill and what to do if there's a fire and how to protect people. You would need to have something similar for what if a giant man-eating bird shows up to start picking people out of your train. What you gonna do about that?
You also mentioned insurance before. This would cause a lot of rewriting and redrafting of new insurance contracts for sure.
Yeah, not good. So evil and complicated. Because, you know, earthquake insurance is extra. Mm-hmm. And flood insurance is extra. So that sort of thing. Are they going to start putting in kaiju exclusion clauses that we're not
categorizing them as acts of God? Or
yeah, we're not going to cover if a giant bird eats people, because that's like, if it's happening that frequently when the insurance carriers are like, no, we're out. Sorry, if this happens, the government's just going to have to bail everyone out because we can't absorb it. And on one level, if you're talking citywide destruction, like what does happen when one of the flowers blows up, you can't, insurance going like, yeah, we basically had a nuclear detonation in a city. It was flattened. There's a big crater where the city used to be and all the buildings got vaporized. That's beyond insurance. I mean, sure, you could try, but what's the response of insurance going to be? It's like, we literally have to rebuild. That's a Marshall Plan type response.
Right, right.
That's something the federal government should do. It does raise an interesting question on life insurance. If, you know, like, would they go bankrupt? Because if you have, say, 50,000 people get killed in a kaiju incident, and everyone, let's say, out of the 50,000, 30,000 had $100,000 life insurance policies, that adds up fast.
Mm-hmm.
And that could break, insurance companies are not designed to absorb that level of loss.
I also would hypothesize that life insurance premiums, especially in Japan, probably went up a lot between Gamera 1 and Gamera 2.
Definitely. It's just, especially if you live in a high concentration area, it's like, so he likes here?
Yeah.
We suggest moving. So that's our advice. You get out of town, property value is going to drop. And
yeah, they do, kaiju attacks do seem to happen in city centers. It is true.
Yeah, it's, you know, like in these creatures, and again, the pseudoscience was wonderful that they're air-powered and it's silicon-based life. So they don't have blood and guts. They're pneumatic. They're full of air.
And yeah, that was really cool.
Yeah, it's like, and they respond to electronic signals. So, you know, Tokyo being one giant light bulb, they go for it. And that's neat. So from a sci-fi alien invasion perspective, this is a creative movie. They do a nice job with it.
Including just the part where they're silicon-based, which I found super interesting. Because it's one of the hardest things, I think, in sci-fi or just even in science is to try to imagine life forms so radically different from ours that they're not even based on the same constituent elements.
Yeah, truly alien. And there are so many parts to Legion that you get the giant flower bulb that is how it reproduces. So one of those things going off would be possibly end of life on Earth, that it'd be an invasive species and it would overwhelm us. So they're really hot to trot to destroy these things because it's like a giant weed growing in the middle of a city that if it goes live, we all die. So there's that. And then you get the different kinds of bugs, which I think the male flew and the female was the big one that I think, I'm not positive, but I think two suit actors operated that costume.
That is what that looked like to me, yeah, because otherwise that would have been quite the feat if you were a single suit actor in that thing. But really cool effects, by the way. This the funny thing is that the suit acting is what has held up the best over time. CGI in the, I believe this is still a 90s movie, is that right, Josh?
Yes.
Definitely not what it is now. You can, you know, a 2020 viewer will discern the difference in the few times where there's pure CGI being used. But the suit acting, because it's, you know, I think the same as Star Wars with the opening scenes where they're using model ships instead of CGI, it holds up really well.
Exactly. And as do the model cities. Everything looks really strong. It's the computer animated Legion when there are bugs flying or overwhelming Gamera that's problematic, but the rest
of it. And I also encourage people not to be dissuaded by that. It is definitely not enough to detract from the movie as a whole. It's very worth watching.
Now, I love this movie for a variety of reasons, but they, it's definitely big. Now we do get into Japan authorizing military force. Yes. And
I am so ready to talk about this. So I don't want to repeat too much of what we talked about in relation to Gamera, Guardian of the Universe. Because of course in Gamera, Guardian of the Universe, this issue where Japan has a unique constitution that essentially incorporates part of the UN Charter directly into its terms, disavowing belligerent war as a means of resolving international disputes. It comes into play in the first movie, and we discussed it at some length there. So I don't want to repeat too much. If people are curious, they should look up that podcast and take a listen. But to build off of it, I thought this would be a useful way to discuss what war is from a legal perspective. So in Gamera 2 Attack of Legion, you actually have, I believe it's like the prime minister or the president, get up in front of cameras and say that we have determined that this is a attack on Japanese soil, and that it actually says under Article 9 of the Constitution, we are permitted to respond with force and we are deploying the self-defense force. I think that it's cute, and I think it's cool that they bring it up, but it is almost certainly not required by legal definitions of what is war. And it's for a couple reasons. So the first is that this very formalistic way that they handle the topic of, you know, use of force and war in Gamera 2 is slightly antiquated. So since especially the UN Charter after World War II, the world has gotten a little bit less concerned and a little bit less wrapped up in sort of this contractual idea of war, which is the formal declaration, we are in a state of war, right? In theory, you could be in a state of war by declaring it, but not actually be in any kind of armed conflict. Conversely, we've had lots of instances since World War II of armed conflict with no formal declarations of war. So the UN Charter is primarily concerned with armed conflict between nation states. So the idea that you would need to have a serious debate in Japan about whether or not Article 9, which disavows the use of belligerent war as a means for resolving international disputes, is implicated by an alien creature assaulting your territory, your soil, is definitely a bit of a stretch. I always joke, of course, Legion in all its various forms has arms. So in theory, this could be an armed conflict. But as I mentioned before, what Article 9 is a little bit unique about is that it appears to incorporate the portion of the UN Charter that forbids belligerent war. However, neither Article 9 of the Japanese Constitution nor the UN Charter forbid nations from doing what we call self-defense, individual self-defense or collective self-defense. Now, there was actually a debate in Japan over the last couple decades about whether or not Article 9 forbade collective self-defense. Collective self-defense is something like NATO, this agreement to defend each other if any nation is under attack. It's an agreement between nation states to defend each other if they're attacked. Individual self-defense is the most straightforward. If your soil is attacked, you respond with force. And there has never been any serious question as to whether or not, at least over the last couple decades, there's not been any serious question about whether or not Japan's constitution forbids it from defending its own territory in the event of an invasion. So even if somehow Legion is considered an armed conflict, an invasion of an armed regular army or something like that, you really don't need to have this whole legal finding that there is an invasion and Article 9 allows you to do it. Article 9 does not disavow Japan's individual self-defense. And that's exactly why it still has a self-defense force. I just want to add, because this is, again, the legal geeks, and I am a geek of legal matters. There is a funny wrinkle here, which is that the UN, under its terms, can authorize use of force that is not strictly self-defense. So the Korean War and the Gulf War are two instances, I believe possibly the only two instances, where the UN Security Council actually authorized the use of military force in a manner that wasn't strictly self-defense. In theory, in order to repel a belligerent act by a sovereign nation, but it's not actually required that you fit this within the legal definitions of self-defense. And it is, again, a topic of debate in Japan about whether or not Article 9 permits them to participate even in a UN-sanctioned use of force such as that.
Yeah. Another way to look at this is if giant insects start terrorizing your country and eating people, I don't think people are really going to debate much about, like, I don't know, that fell under Article 9. Open fire. We'll talk about that later. I mean, it's...
Yeah. I mean, so definitely, yes. There's, you know, the idea that you would need to clear this ahead of time is definitely not the case in reality. This is exactly the kind of thing where you would let the lawyers work it out later. but again, it's also to highlight that these ideas about war in all of our international agreements and Article 9 of the Japanese Constitution are geared at international conflicts. You know, this is, I think, kaiju are often thought of and are sometimes best thought of as a force of nature. It's like a hurricane. It's a volcano erupting. And you don't need to go to Congress to decide, you know, if this were the US, you don't need to go to Congress to get a declaration of war. In Japan, you don't need to get a finding by the Diet that this is definitely an authorized use of the self-defense force to respond to a natural disaster on your own territory. So I think that's the best way to think about it. But even if this were like a Starship Troopers-esque, actually an invasion by some hostile alien insectoid race, again, international law as we currently know it is only concerned with relations and actions between international sovereign states. I don't think any of that would currently apply, and it would be a completely new field that we'd have to start building out international law and precedent if there were an invading hostile alien force from outside Earth.
What they don't touch on, because again, Japan is the hero of the story, and I think mm-hmm. that's important to remember that literally Japan's the hero, and that's why we enjoy this. But if the Americans jumped in under our mutual defense pact that we have,
yes,
that would be interesting if it was just the U.S. military defending a U.S. base. That would not really get a lot of debate because we would be defending our own territory at that point and our own personnel. If we had a carrier strike group to start doing airstrikes on Legion, that would be different. And the Japanese probably would have expected some coordination and a couple phone calls in advance before we cowboy up.
Oh, for sure. Now, go ahead.
But we're allies. We could work it out and go like, hey, there wasn't a lot of time. We saw it was dangerous. It was eating people. We just locked and loaded and we wanted to stop it. And like, we would work it out. Everyone would go like, okay, we see where you're coming from. But hey, call next time. We would hug and everything would be okay. But if China decided to just say suddenly start doing bombing runs on Japan in order to kill Legion, that would raise a new level because they're not allies. They're not frenemies. It would, I mean, technically be an act of war, but if China was like, oh, we saw things were getting out of hand, you know, we didn't want that thing swimming across the ocean towards us, we decided to defend ourselves, that would be super problematic because they launched a military act on another country. And that sort of thing is normally how wars start. So
yes. So just in case people are curious about the sort of quote unquote citations for this, if anyone wants to look it up, I would point people to Chapter 1, Article 2, Subsection 4 of the United Nations Charter of 1945. All members shall refrain in their international relations from the threat or use of force against the territorial integrity or political independence of any state, or in any manner inconsistent with the purposes of the United Nations. So when it comes to, you know, even if China is arguing that, well, we were just wanting to address Legion, and it was clearly a threat to the international community running amok in your country, that would, if China chose to do so unilaterally, it would, I think, be a very easy argument to an international lawyer to say that it was a use of force against the territorial integrity of Japan. I think what you would have to do maybe is at best get together the UN Security Council and authorize a use of force intervention in Japan to deal with Legion. Now, ironically, Japan, despite being one of our closest allies now, is not on the Security Council. And can you tell us why Japan is not on the UN Security Council, Josh?
Probably because of the unpleasantness that happened in the late 30s to 1940s. Germany's not there either. So
yes,
yeah,
essentially the victors of World War II compose the UN Security Council, just as sort of a summarized explanation of that. So despite the fact that Germany and Japan are now some of our closest allies, they are not on the UN Security Council.
Yeah, but they've been good allies. You know, that really cannot be stated enough that they're good allies. And
oh, for sure. And I just want to point out this little bit of trivia. So the Mutual Defense Treaty between the United States and Japan, which was signed on January 19th, 1960, is the longest lasting alliance between two great powers since the 1648 Peace of Westphalia. It is a very great alliance.
Yeah, we're tight. We want to keep it that way. So yeah, better to be buddies.
And again, you're right, Josh, that this is a Japanese movie. Japan is the hero in the movie. But if this were happening in reality, I think there should be little doubt in people's minds that the Mutual Defense Treaty would not just incline the United States to show up and defend its bases, which are, the bases, by the way, are provided by the Mutual Defense Treaty, but that they would show up just to defend Japan and help out as best they can.
You guys got this, right? Cool? Okay, we'll be barbecuing. Like, no, we're good at this. We would lock and load. Like, it's what we do. So yeah, we're used to being heroes. We would go kill the monster. And we do it with our buddies because we're the good guys. Like, that's what we do. So we wouldn't leave them to suffer on their own.
Yes.
That would be so horrible. We wouldn't do that. But that's me. And I come from that school of thought of we're supposed
to. I totally agree, Josh. You're not going to hear me play devil's advocate on that. And I will just emphasize again that at least from an international law perspective, the U.S. would be obligated to show up and help Japan. You know, I can imagine it's not so far-fetched that you would have a president of the United States who is not as keen on international affairs and alliances as previous presidents have been, but nonetheless, they would be obligated to, and I think it would be very difficult to convince the American populace or the American Congress that the United States should not honor its obligations.
Yeah, just with American character, we don't like being told, no, we're going to leave them to die. Like, that never sits well with us. There was an incident in World War II where early in the war, and it wasn't Guadalcanal, it was another, we had troops on an island. We had a task force on our way to go reinforce the island. And they got called back because it was, you know, we were shifting commands from, it was before Nimitz took over, but after Kimmel, and there was a guy in between, and I'm blanking on that admiral who was like in charge for like 2 weeks. And the officers on the bridge of one of the ships started talking about, why don't we just ignore the order and go save our guys? And the admiral who was on the bridge politely just left because he couldn't be part of them discussing open mutiny to go save Americans. But that highlights, we don't like leaving people to die because that's not who we are. So if there was giant insect alien monsters tearing through Japan, we would cowboy up. It's what we do. And
although I do want to credit rather than criticize Gamera 2 for actually mentioning Article 9 and things like that. It was so cool that they did.
Agreed. Absolutely agree. Absolutely agree there. So Whew, a lot to cover. A lot to cover.
And I want to also mention for anyone listening and who's curious, we covered in Gamera Guardian of the Universe a lot of stuff regarding collateral damage, because, you know, in Gamera 2 you have similar things where large numbers of civilians are possibly being killed during some of these military actions that, you know, people who have failed to evacuate quickly enough. So please go ahead and check out that podcast if you're curious about those kinds of topics.
Exactly. So everyone, thank you for tuning in. If you enjoyed what you heard, check us out on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, and wherever you enjoy your podcasts, and leave a review. We have a Patreon, which has some extra content, so check that out. We just have one tier of $5 a month to be of counsel, and you can hear me opine about Watchmen and The Boys and some other shows. And I will be at Nerd Night New York virtually on April 30th at 7 p.m. Eastern to talk about Law of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. And, you know, keep sheltering in place, stay safe, and everyone, take care. See you all soon.